all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. And we're really pleased to have on Veterans Radio today Lisa Silvestri, an assistant professor at Gonzaga University. Lisa, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks, Jim. Hi, veterans.
Well, we are glad to have you because you've got some interesting ideas that you've been working on and writing about. But before we dive into that, our listeners like to know sort of what your relationship is to the military and to veterans in general. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, the family, that sort of thing.
Sure, yeah. Well, I grew up a working class kid in Philadelphia, an Italian family, and all the men I knew had been in some sort of war, going all the way back from my dad's grandfather was in World War One in Italy. It's important I say World War One when I say Italy. and then my grandfather was in the Battle of the Bulge. He was in Patton's army in World War Two. My dad was drafted into Vietnam. He didn't finish high school, and so in 1966, right after his 18th birthday, he got his papers that he was now going to be in the U.S. Army, and he spent 13 months up in Chu Lai and was there during Tet. And then my brother, like I said, coming from a working-class family, my older brother, in order to go to college, he joined ROTC at Penn State, because that's every kid who grows up in Pennsylvania. Their dream school is Penn State. So it was 1995, and he joined the Navy, under my dad's advice. Like, he's like, you know what? The military is a good place to be. I don't know if I trust the government, but, like, the military isn't half bad. And if you do the Navy and it's 1995, you should be in pretty good shape. You'll graduate an officer. And so my brother was commissioned as an officer in 99, but because he is brilliant, far smarter than I am, he got a scholarship. The Navy paid for him to go to medical school. And so by the time he got out of medical school, the Twin Towers had come down and we were involved in two conflicts. And so he got deployed, with the 22nd MU, to East Hit, in and around Ramadi in Iraq in 2005, 2006. And then, again, he was in Helmand province in Afghanistan in 2013. He deployed on Father's Day. Gotta love the timing of that one.
Well, there's a lot of stories like that where we got our orders and scratched our heads and said, wasn't anybody looking at the calendar? Now, does your brother still serve, or did he get out?
He actually, just in October, Jim, he retired as a Navy captain, but he's still in the reserve, and he is working as an anesthesiologist and pain doctor at the VA in West Virginia.
Well, that's great. We appreciate here on Veterans Radio the service of a family such as yours. Clearly, the Silvestris have given back to their country many years of service, and we often find that there is that sort of story. Now, you did not go to Penn State University. You did your undergrad at Indiana University. I'm sorry, no, you...
I actually started out at Penn State. So I did 2 years at Penn State. I went on a diving scholarship. So I was really grateful for that, because otherwise I probably would have had to do some sort of military service also. But I was recruited to Penn State and dove at Penn State for 2 years, And then I qualified for the 2004 Olympic trials. And so I transferred to Indiana University because Indiana was where the national headquarters was for U.S. diving. And I majored in journalism and graduated from the Ernie Pyle School of Journalism.
Oh, there you go.
At Indiana. Yeah.
And then you went on and picked up your master's degree from Indiana University as well?
Yep, yeah. So a little bit of a different direction from journalism, but similar in the communication and culture department. So if journalism was about believing that you could uncover and represent a core truth, the communication culture department kind of really messed with my thinking in that regard, and they taught me that truth is constantly evolving and multidimensional, and it's hard to really get at it. And so that kind of dashed my hopes of being like, you know, a Katie Couric or something. And so I continued on and got my PhD at the University of Iowa to keep developing that line of thought.
Well, one of the things we often find interesting from talking to people about how the military impacted people's lives in different ways. Obviously, it gave your brother a whole new approach from the working class Philadelphia family he came from. But I also think it probably put a little steel in your backbone. Who would have thought you'd go on to get a doctorate in communications and now find yourself a professor at Gonzaga University in Spokane, Washington? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first, I think that's really funny. My dad was a carpenter my whole life, and like I said, he didn't. He got out of high school young, and he still says, he's like, I don't know where you and your brother came from. He's like, I hated school, and you two went as far in school as you possibly could until they wouldn't give you any more degrees. And so it's a running joke in our family, but it's because my brother and I teased my dad that we just didn't want to haul shingles and swing hammers with him anymore. So.
Well, that's an incentive.
Yeah. But so I found my way to this job at Gonzaga University, and it's different than my educational background because I went to all state schools. And so this is a small liberal arts college, and it's really, because of its roots in the Jesuit tradition, it's really committed to social justice and just like a firm spiritual grounding that I find to be really refreshing and something that we're maybe lacking in the rest of our culture.
Well, let's turn now, if we might, to another subject that's near and dear to your heart, and we're talking to Professor Lisa Silvestri, who's a assistant professor at Gonzaga University, and the author of a book called Friended at the Front, Social Media in the American War Zone. Lisa, tell us a little bit about the idea here, and how you got yourself into writing a book on social media in the American war zone.
Yeah, well, I wish it were only six words, but it's not. It's considerably longer. But I was in my graduate school program when my brother was in Iraq. And like a good graduate student, I was trying to think about, like, well, what do I really care about? What do I want to write about? Because at the end of graduate school, you have to write this big book-length project that they call a dissertation. And so I started thinking early on about, like, what is it that bothers me? And I've always been bothered by war, mostly because it takes all the men I love and puts them in these, like, horrendous scenarios. And so war had always bothered me. My brother was currently deployed. And what was happening was the Abu Ghraib photos were coming out, and so I thought that was really curious, the whole idea of digital photography and that these kids were taking photos, and they reminded me of like the snapshots that friends would take at like a party or something, and I'm like, that's really strange. They look different than my dad just had like a handful of black and white photos from his 13 months. But then by the time my brother came home from Iraq, he had like CDs of images, like tons of photos that he loved sharing. And so I thought I was going to be writing about handheld digital cameras and how that was changing the war experience. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll go to the Iowa Army National Guard base and I'll start local and I'll just ask a bunch of like broad interview questions and see if I'm on to anything. And so when I started asking these guys and gals about their digital photography habits, and this is around 2010, they were like, oh, well, it's Facebook, ma'am. Everybody's on Facebook. And I was like, what? I wasn't even on Facebook, and I didn't think that they had that kind of access. And so, of course, my brother had deployed with the Marines, and we know that all the service branches have their ideas about who's toughest. And so my brother said, well, you can't ask a bunch of Iowa Army National Guard guys. They stay on the base the whole time. They're not, like, really out in the cops and fobs, in the foothills and all that stuff. So you got to ask Marines. If Marines are doing it, then you're onto something. So I set up a bunch of interviews in Okinawa, Japan, because that was the hub where they were deploying in and out of the Middle East. And so I was getting young, mostly men, because they're Marines, fresh from deployment. And so I was asking them, like, are you guys on Facebook? And they're like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I keep my phone in my extra grenade pouch. And I was like, what is happening? This is so different. And mostly it's because these personnel are so young. Like, they don't know any different. So they grow up with a cell phone in hand, and of course you're going to take it into a theater of war.
This is, I think, particularly interesting because it's so new. It's in the last maybe 5 to 10 years that this phenomena has really had an impact on the front line at the war. Old veterans like me remember going into port and getting mail call once every 30, 60, 90 days. You'd get a big stack of mail, then you'd have to put the envelopes and the magazines and things in chronological order so that, you know, you kind of didn't read it in the wrong order. You'd get all screwed up. So, but as you explored how Facebook was impacting the troops, what sort of things did you learn?
Well, and I should be careful to say, I mean, it is MOS dependent, and it is geographic and commander dependent. Like, not all commanders will let their personnel engage on social media in the field. So there is variation, but the basic commonality that I heard among all of the personnel was, yeah, it's really nice. Like, I get to know what's going on back home, which is, you know, every soldier or anyone can relate to that, wanting to know what's going on back home. But now there's this, like, lore, there's a pull to find out. And so they have this instantaneous connection to the home front that this one Lance Corporal said, it feels like having one foot here and one foot there. And I think, like, even civilians can relate to that, where, you know, you're at work and your phone is buzzing with a crisis at home. Like, your kids got into trouble at school, or your wife got in a car accident or something that is drawing your attention away from the present situation. And so when that present situation could be lethal, when you're in a theater of war, it, you know, ups the ante on that distraction a little bit. And so I feel badly for these young servicemen and women, because they're responsible for a much broader emotional spectrum than the generations of warfighter that came before them. Because now not only are they dealing with the present problems and what is facing them physically, but they're also having to think about what's going on back home when in previous conflicts there was a buffer there. One of my dad's anecdotes that kind of inspired this thinking for me was he never, stereotypical Vietnam vet, like never really talked about it. But he did say one thing over breakfast when I was about like 15 years old, and I'll never forget it. A Beatles song came on. My mom had this little kitchen radio. And he kind of like chuckled to himself and he goes, you know, when I went away, the Beatles were singing I Want to Hold Your Hand. And when I came back, they were singing Hey Jude. And I was like, what the hell happened back here? And there was this like separation for him between his time in Vietnam and then his time home. And now there isn't that same, the transition is a lot finer for these young men and women.
Did you also find that, I mean, certain amount of life is you have a bad day and you have a good day and you have a bad day, but when you're doing letter writing, that sort of averages out, whereas social media is sort of instantaneous. So you're either communicating your bad day or hearing about somebody's bad day, and it impacts you differently, I would think.
Yeah, I think so. And because of, like, OPSEC and all these other pressures that the Marines that I talk to, because my book is I just interviewed Marines, for the most part, they tried to stay pretty upbeat, or they didn't post very much at all beyond like hot out or like I miss home cooked food. They're pretty careful about what they posted for the most part, but they were receiving a lot. For example, the Lance Corporal who told me it's like having one foot there and one foot there, one foot here and one foot there. He quit Facebook. He was a truck driver, and so he was having to go out of the wire a lot, and he just felt like it was too much of a distraction. He just couldn't handle having a foot in both places. And his girlfriend of 3 years broke up with him because she couldn't understand why he would want to quit Facebook. And I think that's a moral conundrum that we're all presently facing, right? To log off or not to log off. And so I think that, you know, I wish that there was more understanding from the civilian public that buffer is important sometimes.
I think so. Now this would have been, you said it was 2010 when you did most of the interviewing. And technology has moved so fast. I don't know if, I'm not sure where Skype was in 2010 or FaceTime. Did those video options, were those discussed in your work?
So as I found that the Skype wasn't as big of a distraction because a Skype call was almost like the good old sat phone calls where it was an event. Like you got to Skype with your family, see your kids' faces or something for like 10 minutes. And then that was it. Whereas the Facebook, like the constant kind of small, in communication studies, we call it phatic, phatic, phatic communication, which, when you're face to face with someone, it's just kind of like a head nod or just like, hey, how are you doing? Like this, phatic communication serves to let another person know that the line is open for communication. And keeping the line open over the course of like an 8 to 10 month deployment is really exhausting. Whereas Skype, it's like the line is open, we're talking, and then the line closes.
That makes a lot of sense. I've heard stories from returning veterans from Afghanistan or Iraq where they said, well, yeah, once a month or once a week we'd have a Skype call, but it had to be at a certain time, certain location, and if I couldn't get there by such and such a time, I'd, you know, I let my wife know or my girlfriend know, hey, I'm not going to make this week's call. What you're really talking about is sort of the omnipresence of social media, where I can throw you a Facebook message or something whenever I want, whatever time I want.
Interesting.
One of the stories that our family has is that my nephew, who was a Marine in Afghanistan in about, I think, 2009, he and his wife over Skype opened the envelope to reveal the sex of their second child together. And they hold that as a, you know, one of the few precious moments through that year's deployment. But again, a very unique way in which communication can occur, as compared to when you would have had to wait a month to get a letter, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they were in that moment, they were sharing space and time. And that is unheard of. I mean, unless the war was on our soil, that's amazing. And like, not to forget about the Gulf War guys. I mean, theirs was a little faster than Vietnam, maybe, but like, not by much. Like you said, it was a sudden. In my book, I estimate that it was between 2008 to 2012 where this just became normative, like instant, omnipresent contact with the home front.
And we're talking to Professor Lisa Silvestri, who's at Gonzaga University and wrote Friended at the Front, Social Media in the American War Zone. Lisa, in your work, did you get any insight as to how the Department of Defense and the military commanders up the chain sort of viewed this changing technology and changing communication pathway between soldiers and their loved ones back home?
Yes. So the military hierarchy, and your listeners all know this well, is a top-down chain of command. It's very structured, and it's usually white-haired dudes at the top with a lot of brass on their collar. And then at the bottom are these, like, 18, 19-year-old grunts. And, I mean, I just ask listeners, who do you think knows more about social media? And, it has presented a real problem. I mean, social media is about, like, freedom of expression and presenting your identity and being yourself. And it's completely at odds with the culture and the institution of the military. I mean, like, they've had to rethink things like fraternization, which is, like, you're not supposed to, in the military, like, be... have a friendly relationship with your CO, your commanding officer. And on Facebook, I mean, you can have your CO as a friend.
Interesting.
Because it's a Facebook friend. And yeah, and so it's really kind of like a 52-card pickup in terms of the military having to figure out, well, what does this mean and how do we police this? And it ends up being... in my book, it's almost like a eerie parallel to the very, like, ephemeral nature of terrorism, of, like, this, like, we'll know it when we see it, like, we can't quite, like, it's just hard to trust, it's, like, just...
Well, if people are interested in reading Friended at the Front, Social Media in the American War Zone, where can they find this, Lisa?
Well, it's published through the University of Press at Kansas, but it's also, I mean, it's on Amazon. I think Walmart was carrying it. So if you just Google it, it'll come up somewhere.
And rightfully so, it's even in a Kindle edition, because we're talking technology, so you should read it as an ebook. So I want to thank you, Lisa Silvestri, for spending time with us today talking about topics near and dear to our veteran radio listeners' heart. And I wish you best of luck on the projects that you're working on to help get the story out about how military experiences have changed it for veterans.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for your support. And, you know, I just encourage veterans listening to tell their story, and especially the older veterans, to just be a mentor for these young guys and gals who are struggling with some of the same issues they struggled with.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.